Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Literature in Theory and Practice, this week on Soundings. My guests are Myra Jalen of the University of Pennsylvania, Paul Hunter of the University of Chicago, and Shannon Ravenel, senior editor at Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Soundings begins this week with a conversation featuring Myra Jalen and Paul Hunter. Our topic is the impact of theory upon the study of literature. Following that discussion, I'll talk with Shannon Ravenel about the contemporary American short story. Myra Jalen is the author of American Incarnation, The Individual, the Nation, and the Continent, recently issued in paperback by Harvard University Press. Paul Hunter is the author of Before Novels, The Cultural Contexts of 18th Century English Fiction, published last summer by W.W. Norton. Let's talk about literature and the isms. You know, I can come up with an arbitrary list: Marxism, feminism, minimalism. Myra, have we reduced the study of literature to a series of abstract isms that, in effect, bewilder the common reader?
I don't think so. I think that that's been the way it's been increasingly represented, that it's perhaps an easy way to report on the critical scene, to identify the terms, the words that stand out and that have a sort of sexy ring to them, and they all end in an ism. And there are moments when people become very involved with one or another issue in criticism and indeed begin to talk about it from that perspective in a rather exclusive way. But I think certainly at the present time that the ism problem is very much exaggerated.
Well, where does this come from? Paul Hunter, let me turn to you. Every year, for example, the Modern Language Association will meet, and some smart aleck reporter will write a piece about, can you believe what these eggheads are looking at? Look at all these crazy topics. And many times, these articles get reduced to the isms. Now, I take it, you know, following what Myra Jalen has said, this is just an altogether unfair representation.
Well, it's a very convenient way of thinking about things. If you can reduce things to something that you can write a paragraph about, or if you can have a book that has a chapter on post-structuralism and Marxism and feminism and all the isms, then it sort of gives you an easy map to things. And I think it's true that a lot of discourse, particularly in the last 10, 15 years, has been conducted within the framework of one ism against another ism. I think we're past that. It seems to me that the ism-isms is over.
All right.
And not because the ideas that have been represented in any of the isms are really gone. I think a lot of that has been absorbed into a kind of larger discourse. Most people now, it seems to me, most graduate students anyway, at least that generation of people, have really done their thinking about where they stand. They are self-conscious about the kind of ideology they hold. And I think the question now sort of becomes, what do you do after ideology?
Well, let me put this question to Myra Jalen. Do we equate ideology, the isms that we have discussed here outlined, with theory? Is that the word that that proves difficult for the common reader?
I think, well, I'm not sure if that's a word. I'm not sure who the common reader is. I mean, I think there are many people who read. It's always risky to define a common reader, and I don't think I'd want to get into that now. But I think that ideology and a set of ideological and historical and social concerns was certainly at the heart of this issue of the ism. I think if we put it a little bit into context, the entrance into critical discussions of Marxist or feminist concerns came in reaction to something. It came in reaction to a period in which literary criticism was done absolutely devoid of any larger concern and out of context with and out of any historical or social context.
Local politics, for example.
Certainly, for a long time, and I think, you know, Paul and I were both raised in this methodology, and I think we both remember it vividly. There was a period when one was not allowed to mention the name of the author of a book, because that was already to somehow narrow down its literary violate its literary integrity. And that, I think none of us want to go back to that view of literature, and certainly none of us would want to call that a broader or more available to the common reader way of dealing with literature.
Talk to me for a few minutes about one of our principal isms, feminism, and the how does it stretch the envelope? How does it close the discourse, open the discourse? To what ends?
Yeah, well, I think feminism is an excellent representation of the ways in of the reasons that is it as a case it embodies both the reason for the rejection of an older kind of criticism, as I was describing it before, which dealt with literary texts in a vacuum, and also points the direction that Paul has just been describing. Feminism as a critical method began with a very simple proposition, which was that there was a problem, that is, a problem in the sense that there was something to be discussed about the status of women, both within literature and in the creation of literature. That there was something to be said about that, that there were issues to be raised about it.
That weren't being raised.
That were certainly not being raised.
Even ignored.
So long, well, even denied.
Yeah.
That is, explicitly denied, so long as literature was treated as something that simply arose out of some non-agented process. Mm-hmm. There was possibly an artist to be considered, but the ultimate representation of the artist was entirely embodied in the text, which and between the two of them, they normalized each other in such a way that one could not raise problems about either the literature or the person who had created the literature.
Well, let me see if I can push you to be a little bit more concrete, Myra. I'm thinking, for example, of the study in literature in the late 20th century of things like romances, detective fiction, the kinds of literature that have existed, as it were, at the margins, that they weren't the forms of literature that didn't have a respectability to them, typically or traditionally in the academy. Does feminism use those as entrance means to achieve a sort of legitimacy? Is it the other way around? Help me to understand the causality.
Yeah,
here.
No, I mean, there's certainly one of the subjects that feminism has addressed has been the nature and the status of a more popular literature, of a less established, less canonical set of texts. I think that that's certainly the case, but not exclusively by any means. The first major work of feminist criticism, which is now some 20 years old, was a book called Sexual Politics, which talked precisely about the canon, about books which were written by men, and raised the question about those books of the representation in them of women and the sorts of assumptions that the authors had brought to writing, so that by the time they began to imagine women, they were already active members of a society, and therefore all of their membership in that society was distilled in the creation of certain kinds of characters and certain kinds of literary forms. So I think certainly that one of the byproducts, and perhaps one of the direct products of raising social issues, and feminist issues are a set of social and cultural issues, about literature was to raise the question of what constitutes literature, mm-hmm. and what we mean by literature. Do we mean a set of established texts which define the high and the serious? Do we mean that which is written in a culture and in a society, and mm-hmm. then the question of value becomes a real question rather than something simply to be proven? Mm-hmm. So certainly I think feminism has contributed materially to the re-evaluation of the importance of all kinds of literature, but I don't think that that's been by any means its exclusive ground.
Mm-hmm. Paul Hunter.
I think the novel has been a kind of bellwether in a way for this kind of study. I immediately think of some exceptions to that. I mean, I think that probably the way history came back into literary study in the beginning involved plays more than it did novels. But it seems to me that in the past 2 or 3 years, particularly, study of the novel has begun to really absorb some of the large currents that make history, a larger understanding of history, really important to literary texts. And the question of theory in relation to that is complicated, but I think the way it goes is more or less this way, that a lot of theory is absorbed into the new directions of history. We could talk about what those directions are. And I'd like also to say something about this marginal question, because it seems to me that there's an easy way to sort of dismiss, or that there's a temptation to dismiss any kind of study which tends to study texts that haven't that don't have a comfortable place in the canon. In some ways, we're still not beyond that kind of canon question. What worries me is that, and it worries me to some extent about the recent history of the Academy, is that we've come to talk too much to each other. The way I see it now, at least the way I hope it's working, I think this is having its effect anyway in undergraduate education, is that the ways that we begin to have of talking about whole cultures, the ways we begin to have of sorting out where writing belongs in a culture, also give us ways of sorting out where reading belongs in a culture. And these are questions not of reader response in the more theoretical kind of sense of the term, but these are questions about what happens to readers in real cultural context. Huh. I don't think what I'm trying to do is to recruit students as English majors or to get them to read Shakespeare or to read Henry Fielding or somebody else that I'm interested in. Though I want them to, when they read those things, I want them to read them with intelligence and with a kind of richness of meaning that grows out of a combination of their own interests and the interests that are brought to the text from the culture from which it comes. But I want them to pick up new texts, and I want them to be able to read those texts with the same kind of energy, with the same kind of knowledge, with the same kind of enthusiasm. It seems to me that's what we do with undergraduates, is teach them to read.
Mm-hmm. Myra, I'll give you the last word.
I would say that I would teach, what I do is teach reading as a mode of power, really, a mode of reading as one of the most important ways in which we apprehend the world in which we
Absolutely.
Live.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that if you don't speak the language of your culture, you can't have a dialogue with it, let alone persuade it of anything that you want to try to persuade it of. And I think that that's what happens ideally in an English classroom, is that the language of a student's culture is enlarged. That enlarged, deepened, that a self-consciousness and the use of that language happens, that people learn to read their world. And that means then being able to also write their world.
Myra Jalin teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Paul Hunter is a professor at the University of Chicago. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During recent fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Myra Jalin and Paul Hunter worked on projects in literary criticism. Soundings on Literature in Theory and Practice continues. My guest on the following portion of the program is Shannon Ravenel. Shannon Ravenel is senior editor at Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. She's also the editor of a volume entitled The Best American Short Stories of the 80s, published by Houghton Mifflin. Shannon Ravenel, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Let's talk about the short story. Is it healthy these days?
I think it's very healthy indeed. They say it's having a renaissance. More publishers are open to publishing short story collections by single authors. Anthologies are selling better, and I know that personally. The story seems to be of more interest to perhaps more readers. Uh-huh. I'm not sure.
Has the short story itself changed? Discuss
yes,
that for me.
I think it has changed a lot. Probably not so much since I got involved in it, but certainly since the days of what was known as the short story heyday, which were the days in the 20s and 30s when the short story writers could sell stories to slick magazines for big prices.
Were there people who actually made a living? Sustained themselves
most famous case, of course, is F. Scott Fitzgerald, whose uh-huh. story sold for many thousands of dollars. A story.
Right.
That doesn't happen even now with anybody. Even Norman Mailer, I think, there's a limit on how much you can sell a short story for now. But certainly the stories that were sold for big prices in the 30s and in the 20s were not the same thing that we're talking about in the short story renaissance of the 80s.
All right, now what did writers write about back then, as it were? You mentioned Scott Fitzgerald, for instance, Hemingway, people like
they
that.
They wrote entertainments as opposed to literature, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's
a word that Graham Greene uses to
entertainment.
Well, yeah, to characterize some of the work that he kind of dismisses, if I've got this right. Is that the way those writers looked upon their stuff?
No, I don't think they dismissed themselves because the
frothy, lighthearted.
The stories that people talk about now,
mm-hmm.
when they talk about a renaissance, they are harking back, I think, in a funny sort of way, they're harking back to an era that was quite different from what we're experiencing now. And in fact, the so-called Renaissance is not a Renaissance. It's something different.
A resurgence of sorts.
Well, it's a different kind of interest in the short story than the one that reigned in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether this is oversimplifying things or not, but I think that the short story back then had the same kind of appeal that sitcoms on television have now. The Cosby Show. Every Cosby Show is kind of a good, frothy, short story.
Has a beginning, a middle, and end.
A beginning, a middle, and end. Each one of the shows kind of concentrates on one of the children.
Right.
And comes to a conclusion that may or may not have sort of a little moral to mm-hmm. it.
And by contrast, today, what are short story
short
writers
stories
doing?
Are not... Short story writers now are serious writers. They're not able to sell their stories to any slick magazines because there are no more slick magazines in the business of publishing.
The New Yorker's the one exception?
There are a few more than that. But in the old days, there were weeklies, lots of them, that paid big sums of money for those stories. Now there is one weekly, the New Yorker, that publishes now one story a week,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to two stories a week about 5 years ago. And there are several monthlies like Esquire and Atlantic and Harper's who publish maybe one story a month.
Mm-hmm.
But even those magazines do not pay enormous prices. They pay about the same as were paid in the 30s, mm-hmm. which is about $1,000.
Do you think of yourself, Shannon Ravenel, as a shaper of public taste or
a reflector of
public taste? how does it work? I mean, to edit is to make choices and to discriminate and to put certain things high on the list and other things low on the list. How does all of that work? You read 2,000 stories a year?
Well, let's say I did read 2,000 stories a year because I've taken myself away from that job after, 14 years, 13 years, thinking that really I had done it long enough. And mm-hmm. I also have another job that's grown time-wise, so I couldn't afford the time to do it anymore the way I wanted to do it. But I never thought of myself as a shaper of taste.
Well, to a writer, I mean, somebody, if I had written a short story and I said, here
makes
I am talking to Shannon Ravenel, boy, I mean, that you're a powerful person.
It was funny. When I took this job, I took the job of series editor of the Best American Short Stories in 1977 when I was living in St. Louis. And there was a monthly party with the same people at it in St. Louis. It's sort of a literary group of people in St. Louis, and we were good friends, and I went to the party the few days after I'd taken this job and offered it, and certainly took it with great gusto. And Stanley Elkin said, "My God, such power." And I thought, he's crazy. I mean,
it's true, though.
But it is, I guess it turned out to be true. But I don't think I'm a particularly modest person, but I never thought of myself as shaping the taste. I always thought of myself as identifying what was good, selecting it, and handing it over to a guest editor who needed to have the field narrowed.
Well, let's talk about some of the criteria that you bring to your choices as a series editor. Are you an adherent or a critic of literary theory?
No.
We talk about semiotics and deconstruction and all these wonderful terms.
No, I'm interested in what they mean, because often those terms are very useful. If you understand what they stand for, and you need to explain your choices to yourself, you may find yourself relying on what you understand about literary theory. But I'm not a scholar of this, and in fact only recently have I come to understand what deconstruction means, at least to Lewis Rubin, who says it's close reading.
Uh-huh. Do you think that critics are creators? That's one of the notions that to some people weighs heavily on the literary enterprise these days, that that the critic after a fashion is as creative as the people who produce the fiction and the poetry.
I think there's so many influences on what is in style, in literature. Critics are just one part of it. I'm in the business end of it as a publisher, and it's not just critics. It's many more mundane things than that. Of course, they have their effects, but I think they are only one of many, including the public and what it wants to read.
How do you gauge public taste, Shannon Rumlow? Do you worry about that? Or, I mean, do you just say, well, I like this stuff, therefore I'll publish it?
With The Best American Short Stories, it was a very pure job. I simply...
Just you and the book.
Just me and the stories. Mm-hmm. The stories. No, I did not choose the stories for the book.
You choose the editors.
I chose the editors, right. And then the editors, I would give the guest editor, we had a different famous guest editor, writer, every year, most of the time short story writers themselves, I would hand them my favorite 120 stories, gleaned from 2000, from the pages of about 200 magazines.
Goodness, how do you keep track of all of that?
With little note cards and, you know, pieces of paper and
sure.
Lists and very elaborate, that nobody but me will ever see. But the idea in my head was just to hand them 120 really good stories and let their taste reign. And many times they didn't choose all of the 20 stories that were selected for the final book from my selections. They had their own ideas about things, and that was fine too.
Shannon Ravenel, give me a sense of some of the short fiction that stays in your mind. I don't want to put you on the spot and have you name names and name favorites, but the kinds of things that resonate, that come back to you, that you enjoy.
When people ask me questions like that, always the thing that leaps into my mind is what I'm reading at the moment or working on at the moment.
That's
a good
answer.
I have to say that today what sticks in my mind is a wonderful collection of short stories by a Southerner whose name is Lewis Norden. And he's unknown. He shouldn't be unknown. He's published two collections already, and a third one will be coming along. But he is an absolutely wonderful writer of the Southern grotesque. I see that I'm not mentioning any women, and that's very bad. So I should talk about Joy Williams and Ursula Le Guin, the wonderful science fiction writer who is literary of all things.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a new lady coming up named Deborah Joy Corey, who I think is going to be wonderful. She's already wonderful. People just have to come to her.
Shannon Ravenel, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, and let me put a question on the table that maybe we should have started with this, but let's see where it takes us as we wrap up our conversation. What is a short story? One writer says that it's a song, not a symphony, that it's something literary where, quote, something happens in front of us. Another critic defines it as a piece of writing that has an emotional impact. Is there a way that you would define it, or is that really sort of beside the point?
No, I don't think it is beside the point. I think it's a good question, and I think that the short story, in my terms, a short story is closer, in my view, to the poem than it is to the novel. It is not a short novel. It is in prose, and it does, I think, have to have a beginning, middle, and end, but you can define those in a lot of funny and interesting ways. In my view, something has to change in the story, that there has to be the old Aristotle's old theorem of recognition, that the main character, and there are some stories that don't have human beings in them, and they work too.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, we could say that the main character has to have some change in his recognition of how things work or how he works that turns him a little bit in the direction of his life.
Is that what short stories do to readers?
Well, I don't know. You could hope. Is that what a good poem does? You could hope. I don't think so, probably, but I think it speaks to, the recognition factor is, as in poetry, what is wonderful about reading a poem that works is that it's like a little ice pick through your brain to some part of your brain that you know,
right.
And that it didn't, who was it, Sartre or Camus, who called a poem an ice pick into the frozen lake of the heart.
I remember. Keats or Shelley says something about poetry says to us things that we've known all along,
but
had never really expressed them as well as that.
And didn't think anybody else thought so.
Yeah.
As well, it's a human contact, in words, and it's the story. I think a good story does that too, has to.
Shannon Ravenel is senior editor at Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Shannon Ravenel is also the editor of The Best American Short Stories of the 80s, published by Houghton Mifflin. Soundings on Literature in Theory and Practice is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 538. That's program number 538. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the life and political times of Governor George Wallace of Alabama. My guest will be Dan Carter, an historian from Emory University. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Literary Theory and Literary Practice, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Myra Jalen of the University of Pennsylvania and Paul Hunter of the University of Chicago discuss the impact of theory upon modern literary scholarship and criticism. Shannon Ravenel discusses her work as editor of The Best American Short Stories of the 80s. Literature in Theory and Practice, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.